Good morning. Let's take our Bibles and turn to Esther chapter 3. Esther chapter 3. Have you ever heard that phrase, the best laid plans of mice and men? Something that I was looking at this week, and by the way, a big event if you have a Scottish heritage. On January 25th of this past week, this was past Wednesday, there was an observance that's been going on since, I think, 1801. Every year, Scottish people have a special meal on January 25th in honor of their national poet, Robert Burns, who died in 1796. But they celebrate his birthday. Robert Burns may be a name that's unfamiliar to you because you are not Scottish. But you certainly have heard some of his poetry over the course of your life. As a matter of fact, probably a few weeks ago, you were thinking about some words that Robert Burns penned. For he is accredited with writing the song Auld Lang Syne. You know the words to that? You know that song? Should old acquaintance be forgot and never thought upon, the flames of love extinguished and fully past and gone. Is thy sweet heart now grown so cold, that loving breast of thine, that thou canst never once reflect on Auld Lang Syne? Now, Robert Burns wrote with a unique and patently Scottish dialect, and to read his version, we sing certainly a much more modern, adapted version. And there are some words that, as we read what he wrote, we don't understand what he's saying. I guess if you speak it out loud, you can hear and navigate your way through it. But there's a phrase in that song that sometimes we sing words we don't even know what they mean. Do you know what the meaning of the phrase, Auld Lang Syne, there at the very bottom of that stanza? It is a throwback to remembering for the sake of times past. Now, you're talking about a people that celebrate a poet, and they have done so for some 225 years, it seems. 224 years, it seems. 5 years after his death, they established it as a national holiday, and they still enjoy that meal in his honor on that night. You may not have celebrated it, but you certainly do respect his attention to detail for calling us to remember for the sake of times past. Because if we don't, there is a danger of forgetting the past. I know sometimes we just live so long in the past, we think about those sweet days gone by, the Auld Lang Syne. We think about those days longingly. But there were a whole lot of lessons that we had to learn the hard way in those old days. That if we should fail to remember the lesson of the past, it certainly robs us of the hope in the future. And it can stop us in our tracks today, for we find ourselves repeating and doing the same mistakes over and over again. So there's a danger in forgetting the past. I know oftentimes I say if your future is not as bright as your past is, then there is no hope. But you have to remember the lessons that we learned the hard way over the course of the past. There's some grace there. We've seen the Lord work and intervene in our lives and in our circumstances. And I think now another phrase that I would like to look at is that phrase, the best laid plans of mice and men. That's from a poem that Robert Burns wrote to a mouse. When you and I find a mouse in our house, we're not too excited about that. No one likes to see where that little critter has been. I'm going to spare you the details and spare you of all the treachery of reading and hearing poetry this morning, but I would like to look at one stanza in this poem to a mouse. It's a story told about a farmer who is plowing a field, and as his plow furrows through the ground, he uncovers the home of a little mouse. And he stops and he ponders there what he's just done. He's tore up this mouse's house, and he knows what's going to happen. He's going to have to share some food from his barn, perhaps share some warmth in his house because he has displaced this mouse. But he starts to compare himself to the circumstance of the mouse, and we find this farmer who has just opened up the earth and revealed a mouse. We find him waxing philosophical as he says in this stanza, "But mouse, you are not alone in proving foresight may be vain. The best laid schemes of mice and men go often awry and leave us nothing but grief and pain for promised joy." Now, the farmer knows probably best that no matter how hard you plan or how well you plan, surviving today is the common goal. I think farming has got to be one of the great challenges, especially in days where we don't know if it's going to be a dry season, if it's going to be a wet season. Every year I'm overwhelmed when I think about how beautiful our fall can be. And as long as I've lived here in North Carolina, I think I've seen maybe one or two glorious falls as we've seen the trees transition beautifully. I've come to terms with every fall being beautiful, but I remember there were some that were spectacular, and every year I hear the weatherman saying, well, it's not going to be too spectacular this year because we didn't have enough rain at the right time, or we had too much rain in this part of the season, and so it's just going to be kind of bland. Do you remember back to the fall where the trees looked like this year? Do you remember how wonderful it was to see those tree leaves change? And then on top of that, it wasn't that spectacular, I should say, as beautiful autumns go, but it seemed to be really spectacular as far as falling leaves go. We're still gathering up leaves around here at the church. It just seems to be that the Lord really blessed us with a bumper crop of leaves for plenty of work. And the farmer knows that no matter how much you plan, there is going to be some details that you just have to work with. And a farmer knows that when you have planted crops, regardless if it's raining or shine, or if it is icy and snowy, you are going to have to go out and tend to your flocks. You're going to have to tend to your crops because, quite frankly, farming is hard work. And the farmer sees it from this perspective of today, anticipating the harvest of tomorrow. But had they not planted in the past, there won't be a crop to worry about today, and they know there won't be a harvest to realize tomorrow. But Robert Burns' poem takes a little more pessimistic outlook, because he compares himself to the circumstance of the mouse, realizing that this itinerant or this sharecropper who is working the land to provide for his family is probably going to, he's just a small piece in the big puzzle. He's got to share his crops with just everybody. He's going to have to work hard to scrape by. And it's a poem that I come to terms with, and I understand that phrase, "The best laid plans of mice and men often go awry." No matter how hard the mouse plans, no matter how hard the farmer plans, something always comes and throws a kink in the best laid plan. In Robert Burns' poem, as you read it on another level, you start to realize that it's not just about coming to terms with opening up the ground, but his basic takeaway is that you will do what you have to do in order to survive. We live in a land of plenty, and we live extremely blessed. But should the tables turn and should our fortunes change, would you be capable of doing what you must do in order to survive? Or would you give up? When, at what point does hope and optimism begin to fade? But remember, church, but what if God has far more planned than just survival? For oftentimes, when we find ourselves in a difficult place or a place of discouragement, survival seems to be what keeps us going. Just automatically, we move through the day because that's just the way we're built. We've just got to make it through the day. But what if God has far more planned for us than mere survival? in those difficult moments and in those difficult times where we begin to question if hope is ever going to materialize, we arrive at the same question: has God forgotten me? I'd like to look at Jeremiah 29 to answer that question that God has for his people Israel. Jeremiah 29, verses 10 through 14. This is a very famous passage. You'll often hear it shared at a Christian school graduation. It is probably a life verse for you, but I'd like to look at it in context this morning. Jeremiah 29, verse 10. For thus saith the Lord, that after 70 years be accomplished at Babylon, I will visit you and perform my good word towards you in causing you to return to this place. Remember, we're dealing with the story of Israel in Persia. They have been moved from Babylon, and now we're looking in the book of Esther at God's people in a place further away from home. And God has a promise through the prophet Jeremiah that there is something that he is still doing and he is still at work, that he promises to visit, and he will bring to pass his word, what he has promised. And he has promised that Israel will return to the promised land. And on top of that, God knows your tomorrow. Look with me at verse 11. For I know the thoughts that I think toward you, saith the Lord, thoughts of peace and not of evil, to give you an expected end. The scriptures are clear and plain. When life is hard and circumstances are difficult, it's really easy to take on a negative or pessimistic tone. But the Lord is not done with his people, Israel. And he knows what's in store. And he knows what is coming. And for Israel, he says, God will hear your prayer. Look in verse 12. Then shall ye call upon me, and ye shall go and pray unto me, and I will hearken unto you. And there is a promise in God's plan for Israel to return to God. Verse 13. And ye shall seek me and find me, when ye shall search for me with all your heart. And God promises to bring Israel back to the promised land. Verse 14. And I will be found of you, saith the Lord. And I will turn away your captivity, and will gather you from the nations, and from all the places whither I have driven you, saith the Lord. And I will bring you again into the place where I caused you to be carried away captive. I wonder how long Israel has struggled in captivity. First in Babylon, and even though it was allowed and permitted for some to go back to begin to rebuild the city walls and to re-erect the temple, we find in Esther's story, Mordecai and Esther have found their families moved farther away from the promise. How far will that keep you going? Lord, it just seems to be that we're moving in the wrong direction. We're moving further and further away from what you've got in store. And we know what you say. We know that you have a promise for us, and you've got a purpose for us and a plan for us. But God, it just seems to be that we are moving in another direction. And as we look at chapter 3, I'm going to wonder, are they okay with that too? That they're starting to put down roots and be successful in the kingdom. But I want you to see the big point this morning, that God's promised plan never, ever goes awry. So would you join me in prayer as we look to the Lord at this time? Lord Jesus, we come to you now and we thank you so much for Esther chapter 3. The story takes a hard turn where it looks like all hope is lost. And even though you're not named in the book of Esther, we see your hand at work. We see your plans being fulfilled and your promises kept. For you are a promise-keeping God. And Lord, I pray for us, your church, this morning, as our plans and our hopes sometimes begin to fade or go awry, would you renew our hope in you, knowing that you are not done, knowing that you have told us what you will do and that you will bring it to pass. Oh, Lord Jesus, reignite the fires of hope in our heart today through the words in Esther chapter 3. We ask these things in your name. Amen. So Esther chapter 1, we hear about the defiance of Queen Vashti. Esther chapter 2, we find about her replacement, Esther. A beauty contest was held. The king was enamored by Esther, and we looked at that last week. Today, we're going to meet another character where it just seems to be that the book of Esther and Esther's story is just pushed back because there is a big, important detail, and all of the tension in the book of Esther now really ignites and explodes in chapter 3. For we are going to meet some character, and I mean some character, and his name is Haman. Look with me in Esther chapter 3, verse 1. After these things, did King Ahasuerus promote Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agag, and advanced him to set his seat above all the princes that were with him. Now we find the promotion of a character. You remember how chapter 2 ended? Mordecai, who is Esther's uncle, has got a seat of prominence at the gate, and he overhears about a plot to overthrow the king, and he gets word to the king, and the king is very swift to execute judgment on those who would rise up against him. We hear that detail, and rather than Mordecai being promoted, we meet an entirely new character whose name is Haman, and he is elevated to a place above all of the princes. Remember last week when we were looking at the scope and the size of the kingdom, some 129 provinces where these young ladies were pulled from to come before the king. And Haman has got a really big spot of authority in the king's kingdom. And that's going to come to pass. And we're going to see how that plays out and what happens here. Because of all of the things that Mordecai could do, he does not pay honor to Haman. As a matter of fact, he's supposed to, and he doesn't. Look with me at verse 2. And all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed and reverenced Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him, but Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence. He has one job to do as far as Haman is concerned, and that is to bow in submission as Haman walks by. All he has to do is just acknowledge and recognize. And military would be a salute. He just got to show his honor. He's not talking about bowing down and worshiping him, as we see the decrees in the book of Daniel. He's just supposed to acknowledge Haman's place of authority, and he doesn't do it. And if Mordecai had only known the trouble that was going to come, you think that he could at least bow his head, but be defiant at his heart, but he's not. He's going to stand in opposition to Haman. Verse 3, then the king's servants which were in the king's gate said unto Mordecai, why transgresseth thou the king's commandments? The question put before him. They're wanting to know why in the world he won't comply with what the king has said. Why will he not compromise in order to survive, if I could put it that way? It's a simple gesture. He walks by, you bow your head, you show your respect, it's all over. Why won't you do that? You know what? Esther chapter 3 doesn't tell us why he won't do it. We don't know what his answer is. We know a part of his answer, but I don't understand the logic or the reasoning behind it. Look with me in verse 4. This is how the situation begins to resolve. Now it came to pass, when they spake daily unto him, and hearkened not unto them, that they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's matters would stand. for he had told them that he was a Jew. I do not know how in the world that buys him the freedom to defy the king. Because we're not talking about the Daniel story, you know, where the decree was put out where they were trying to trap Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, where they were trying to capture Daniel. This is just recognizing the king's man. But what he does is he reveals his heritage. He reveals that he's an Israelite. And a question that we asked last week, a question that I started to answer, but I wanted to look at it again today. How is it that Mordecai could hide his identity for so long? We remember Israel was taken into captivity. And then there are some that were carried from Babylon into Persia when Persia defeats Babylon. And we find Israel now here in Persia. And I realize that when we consider Israel in captivity, looking back over the course of the stories throughout the Old Testament, oftentimes, almost every time, Israel is enslaved in bondage as servants, slaves for the Egyptians. The Lord sent a deliverer, Moses, to deliver Israel out of Egypt, lead them towards the promised land. We see how the Lord had told Israel through Moses that if you will keep my word, I will bless you and you'll thrive in the land. And if you don't keep my word, you're going to suffer the consequences of your decisions and your failures to follow me. And you're going to find oppression from the inhabitants of the land. And you will not succeed in the land. And Israel's driven out of the promised land when Babylon comes along. The place that they had called home. It hadn't been easy. Though Israel had established kings to lead them, and their kings failed them just about every time. There was a few good ones in there. And then when Israel goes into captivity in Babylon, it just seems like the promised land promise is never ever going to come to pass again. If you were in one of those generations that died in the captivity in Babylon, you wondered how in the world is this going to, how are we ever going to get back home? And then you get relocated over to Persia. How is it that Mordecai could hide his identity for so long if Israel is serving as slaves in Persia? Everyone would have to know, oh, he's a servant. He's a slave. He's an Israelite. But apparently not every Israelite had a bad experience in Persia. And I've got two examples that I can point at really quickly. Mordecai, who's got that seat of prominence at the king's gate, and Esther, who's now queen of the realm under the king. Apparently, something is happening. That some of the Israelites that live in Persia are thriving. And after all, isn't that the dream? That life is easy and that we succeed and that we thrive? And I'm not trying to discount working hard. I'm not trying to say or suggest even in the slightest that you and I should not give our best in a fallen world. Rather, you and I should give our best in this fallen world because our life speaks volumes of the testimony of our great God and our character can be used to impugn his character. Not that we take away from his character, for he is holy, he is separate, he is good. But when people look at our lives and we tell them that we're a Christian, from time to time they begin to question, why in the world would I want to serve his God? Because if that's the way he is, his God can't be worth very much to me. And for Israel, not every Israelite seems to have it rough in Persia. Life is pretty good. I mean, we've got at least two examples here of people who are in the kingdom thriving. The question, though, that we are here at in chapter 3 is, how much damage has Mordecai done to his people? You say, Mordecai has brought harm upon Israel because he refused to salute Haman as he walked by? Look with me at verse 5. And when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not, nor did reverence, then Haman was full of wrath, and he thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone. For they had showed him the people of Mordecai. Wherefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, even the people of Mordecai. So work with me here. Every Israelite in the kingdom is to be destroyed because Mordecai failed to bow to Haman. I don't understand his logic. I don't understand where he feels the license to wipe out every one of Mordecai's people. Is it just here in the kingdom walls in Shushan? I don't think so. I think the plan here is that he is going to, when you realize the enrichment plan that Haman devises, I think it's going to be a lot bigger than just inside the city walls, but rather throughout the kingdom of Ahasuerus. And you remember, Israel's in subjection right now under the Persian rule because they control the entire region. And Haman's plan is to wipe out an entire province of people over a simple act of disrespect. Crazy? You know what he does? He decides the day to do that, that he's going to seek to do this. He casts a lot. He rolls a die, if you will, to decide the day that judgment comes upon Mordecai and his people. Look with me in verse 7. In the first month, that is the month of Nisan, the 12th year of Ahasuerus, they cast pur, that is, the lot before Haman from day to day, and from month to month, and from 12th month, that is the month of Adar. So the event of him casting lot has actually spurned a festival in Israel to remember. You know, we talked a few weeks ago looking at the story of the Maccabees rising up and how that played into the observance of the festival of Hanukkah. Well, we have here, we see because of this pur, this cat lot that they cast, we're going to see Israel is going to also develop a festival known as Purim, which is a celebration that comes up at the 1st of March on our calendars. And we are headed there for, we'll be in this series still when that festival takes place or begins to take place and celebrated by Israelites today. In verse 8, though, look with me at the story. And Haman says unto the king Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of thy kingdom. See, his plans aren't just to wipe out Mordecai and people living inside of Shushan. It's to go a lot further than that. And their laws are diverse from all people. Neither keep they the king's laws, therefore it is not for the king's profit to suffer them. King, you got some people living in your kingdom that aren't allegiant and faithful to you. They are a different people, and they are standing out, and we need to do something about it. So this is his plan in verse 9. If it please the king, let it be written that they may be destroyed. And I will pay 10,000 talents of silver to the hands of those that have charge of the business to bring into the king's treasuries. King, if you'll let me do this, I will take care of funding the operation. We're going to wipe them out, and I will foot the bill. The king thinks this through, and it sounds like a good plan. Can you imagine wiping out the inhabitants of one of your provinces just because the prince of your princes has been humiliated and embarrassed because someone failed to nod their head and bow? The king approves the plan. Verse 10. And the king took his ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agite, and the Jews' enemies. And the king said unto Haman, the silver is given to thee, the people also, to do with them as it seem good to thee. The king is going to fund the plan. Then the king's scribes called on the 13th day of the first month, and there was written according to all that Haman had commanded unto the king's lieutenants. And the governors that were over the province, and to the rulers of every people of every province according to the writing thereof, and every people after their language, in the name of King Ahasuerus, it was written and sealed with the king's ring. I mean, the king has put his stamp of authority on this plan for Israel to be destroyed and plundered. Look with me at verse 13. And the letters were sent by posts into all the king's provinces, to destroy, to kill, and to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, even upon the 13th day of the 12th month, which is in the month of Adar, and to take the spoil of them for a prey. I know that whenever you watch perhaps an old movie, you think about how it is that the villain... I never understood this, why the villain would reveal his plans. And he sets out an elaborate detail. And you think to yourself, well, he's just undoing himself by setting himself up to fail because he's cast dice to pick a day that they're going to wipe out every Israelite in the kingdom. It seems to be that the plan has got some problems with it, but no, it's got the king's full support. The king has set out in a letter, an announcement, and he has authorized the destruction of every Israelite in the kingdom. And a people that were living in Persia and perhaps thriving in Persia, their fortunes are going to change on a day that is barreling towards them. For in order for Israel's fortunes to change, you've got to own something to have it taken away. So I think that Israel is thriving in Persia because part of the reward for wiping them out is taking everything that they own. That means that they will no longer thrive in Persia. But when you take it away for the story and you look back, okay, they're not just losing all of their material possessions. They're going to lose their life and they will no longer survive in Persia. And the story takes a dramatic turn here when you start to realize the significance of what is in play. Israel's identity, Israel's future is in jeopardy. Look with me at verse 14. The copy of the writing for a commandment to be given in every province was published unto all people that they should be ready against that day. The posts went out, being hastened by the king's commandment, and the decree was given in Shushan the palace. And the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city Shushan was perplexed. I told you the conflict in chapter 3 is just, here we have the story set in motion. And it just seems to be that if you look at what's going on here, if you're keeping track of the story, that day is coming. That day, judgment day is set. And Israel has got to be living in great dread. For the king and Haman are celebrating this plan. And I want to push pause because we're at the end of chapter 3 and we're now at the end of the message. And we are here in this story. I want you to just take a deep breath as we step back and look at the greater implication of what Haman has decided. We opened up a few moments ago looking at God's plan to return Israel to the promised land. He was going to send his people back to the land that he had given them. And if Haman has his way, God's plan will be thwarted. That means there's no redemption for Israel. Because remember, going to the promised land was an indication that Israel had gotten right with the Lord. That in the time of testing and judgment when she was outside of the land, that God's people turned back to him and cried out for him in deliverance, and he carries them back into the promised land. And he would deliver them from life outside of the promised land, a life that some people had gotten comfortable with and that some people had just made concessions with and said, you know what, we may never ever get back, so let's just seek about setting our roots here in Persia. And in that instant that Haman has schemed his plan, all of the future hopes of Israel outside of the land have been uprooted. And not just they're living in poverty, but they will not survive. So we have that implication. Haman is going to prevent Israel from going back to the promised land. He's going to prevent Israel from turning back to God because he's going to bring them to a place of judgment. Maybe in the course of time that is Israel sees that day coming, Israel steps up and changes her ways and cries out to God and gets ready for judgment. You know, I think about us and our outlook. You know, not one of us wants to go through a trial or through a difficult circumstance. And you and I often have this perspective. I'm not looking forward to it, but if that's what the Lord has in store with me, I'll have peace about that. And he'll carry me through that, I know. It's because we walk with the Lord and we see him. But there is still some time because the calendar hasn't changed. The day of judgment has not arrived for Israel. But I want you to know the greater implication isn't just that they won't go back to the promised land, that there will not be a deliverer for Israel or deliverance for Israel, but rather going all the way back to Genesis chapter 12 when we see God's promise to Abraham that the whole world would be blessed through Abraham's descendant. Would be wiped out, and that God's people would just become a footnote in history because a man refused to bow his head to the king's prince. The whole world is going to lose the blessing that God has promised. But I want you to step back and realize what that is, because we're talking about God's gift of Jesus. For if God's people are wiped out, where in the world in human history is there going to be the divine intervention of God sending his son into this world? The promise that he gave to David that it was going to be from his family. All of God's promises began to unravel, and we begin to question what God is doing. Even though we don't realize here through Haman's decision that he is stepping up against God. And ultimately, if his plan goes through, there would be no redemption for humanity. Do you see the implications here? Do you see the struggle here about how big this story is in Esther chapter 3? Where in the world do you turn when you don't know where to turn? Where in the world do you find your hope when it seems that all hope is lost? David sings about this in Psalm 138, verse 8. The Lord will perfect that which concerneth me. Thy mercy, O Lord, endureth forever. Forsake not the work of thine own hands. His mercy is more. And when you don't know where to turn, that means you've forgotten the one in whom you should turn. Where to turn when you don't know where to turn was all part of God's plan in Jeremiah's promise. Look back with me in Jeremiah 29, verse 12. Then shall ye call upon me, and ye shall go and pray unto me, and I will hearken unto you. Because God knows precisely where you are at. God knows precisely where his people are at. And it doesn't take a farmer plowing up a mouse's home to realize that the best laid plans of mice and men often go awry, but that God's plan never, ever goes awry. And that brings me hope. For when it seems that all hope is lost, and it seems like life is overwhelming, and it seems like I'm in a place of great discouragement, he knows exactly where I'm at, and he knows exactly what he's doing, even though I don't necessarily know what he is doing. But he is good. He is holy. And he is righteous. And our message comes to a close with this. God's promised plan never goes awry. So this morning, as we begin to make the transition from our pew to the altar, search yourself before you question God's goodness, God's character, God's plan. I don't understand why, for some of us, God's plan involves a lot of heartache and a lot of pain. I don't. I don't understand always what you're going through. And I know sometimes one of the worst things to hear from someone when you're going through a difficult situation is, I know exactly what you're going through because I went through the same thing myself. Because you're thinking in your heart, you have no idea what I'm going through because it hurts. And this is overwhelming. And I don't want to hear that. And if we're not careful and we spend too much time looking at the circumstance, then looking and asking God for direction in the difficulty and in the trial, it gets us to that place where we begin to question his goodness. God, you don't know what you're doing here. We are in Persia, and Haman has risen up, and he's going to wipe us out. And is this how you end the story? Is this what you have for us? You led us to the promised land to take us away from the promised land, which Israel's moral failures took them out of the promised land. But let's give it to them in this moment. God, you've taken us out of the promised land and you've led us here. We're never going back home and we are going to die hopeless and helpless here. But remember, before you question God, search yourself. God, do I see what you're doing here? Am I right with you? Is my heart set towards you, or am I approaching this from a selfish perspective? It's okay to ask questions when life hurts and when circumstances are difficult. But it's not right to question God's goodness, that he does not know what's going on, for he does. And the remedy to that is to trust that he is good. Like the lamb that was led to the slaughter. In God's plan, he spared not his son to purchase our redemption. And if anything, the message of the gospel indicates to us the extravagant lengths that God would go to provide our deliverance, even through the gift of his son, Jesus, as our greatest example. Don't you think that he's got the details? He knows what's going on and he knows where you're at. He knows what you're up against. He knows about your anxieties, your fears, your pressures. He knows about your broken heart. So trust that he is good. But in those moments when you cannot see what he is doing, know that he is good and look for his hand of deliverance. It may be just around the corner. It may be apparent right now. But the lessons that we have from walking with him over the course of our life, we've seen him done it in times past. We know how he's delivered in impossible situations in the past. Why should we expect otherwise today? And rather than expect otherwise today, why should we not look to his promise being fulfilled that he's coming back, that he's coming soon, and that he knows how the story ends? So may this be our prayer this morning. Jesus, restore my faith in you when all seems lost.